You know, one of the things that we have become quite well known for here in recent years is our craft beer industry here in Wisconsin. We have something like 65 craft beers, or more than 65 craft beers, being produced here in the state. Another thing that we've become very well known for, and actually we've always had a great reputation for our cheeses, but in the last many years, kind of along with the craft beer industry, we now have a cheese industry, which you might call a craft cheese industry, that is, I don't think it's second to anybody. And it's really, really a wonderful thing to have the kinds of cheeses that are now being produced here in the state, and frankly, across the country. There are a lot of different wonderful cheese producers, cheese makers here in Wisconsin and across the world. Kirsten Jackson has written a book. It's called It's Not You, It's Brie, Unwrapping America's Unique Culture of Cheese. And we're going to spend the next 45 minutes or so talking with her about cheeses, and certainly looking forward to what you have to say about cheeses. You have a favorite U.S. cheese from Wisconsin here or from elsewhere? Are you ready to branch out? Tell Kirsten what you like, and she'd be happy to give you a recommendation for something new to try. So we're really happy to have her with us by phone today. You can join in with your own questions, comments, or experiences at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. Kirsten Jackson with me by phone. She's a cheese and wine writer, contributor to the LA Times, Kinfolk, Edible East Bay, and NPR's Kitchen Window, and the author of this great new book. It's Not You, It's Brie. And you there, Kirsten? Welcome.
I'm here, Larry. Thank you for having me today.
Oh, it's so much fun. I tell you, well, I wish you could be here in the studio with me, and I wish we had a little cheese to share.
Yeah, I bet. You know, that's one of the benefits of being in this industry, is having plenty of cheese to share.
Oh, well, I tell you, most cheese guides look at cheese according to types, but you say that's not the right model, and I think you've kind of convinced me about that, for talking about American cheese. Talk about how you group them.
Right. Well, I think there are definitely some fantastic guides out there, but as far as categorizing cheese, sometimes with the classic way of doing it, people will group cheese into a semi-hard or semi-soft, and I think that could be a little confusing sometimes, especially when semi-soft might even group a Gruyere style and then a Monterey Jack or a Pepper Jack together, where really you don't use them for the same things in the kitchen, and in many cases they have very different influences. So the way that I categorize the cheese in the book was according to what is prominent here in California, what's been the most influential, just style. Sometimes I did it according to their uses, like soft cheeses, the crumbly cheeses would be like feta, queso fresco, those style of cheeses. And then I have another section for alpine styles. So I'd say they're the big influences here, and sometimes they are a little bit more shaped by culture and history. So people start making those style of cheeses rather than just they're the same texture.
Right. And, you know, I'm thinking here in Wisconsin, but I guess it's probably true across the country. I mean, it's sort of a melting pot of immigrants. Some people call it a salad bowl, you know, in a way.
Uh-huh.
All these cultures that would influence our influence our cheeses.
For sure. And in Wisconsin in particular, you have, a lot of European influence, and definitely in California too. But in California, it's fair to say you're going to see more South American, Central American, Latin American influences with our cheese, and definitely heavy Italian and French. But you go to Wisconsin and you have so much of German immigration, Swiss immigration, and you definitely see that in the cheese in kind of the alpine styles or the firmer styles. even Scandinavian styles too.
Yeah.
So definitely different influences from who, from immigrants who came over here back in the days, and that people that are still coming over now, and what kind of influence they have over the fantastic cheese that we have. It's pretty exciting. I mean, there's lots of opportunity to discover new styles when you have all these new flavors coming in.
Oh, absolutely. And as you say somewhere in your book, probably not going to find a lot of Limburger in California. But it's right here in Wisconsin.
It is. There's just actually one producer of Limburger in the country, Shelly Cheese, and yeah. I had the opportunity to visit them. I think it was 2 August ago. I visited a lot of people from the book, about half the producers. There's about 48 in there, and had a fabulous trip to Wisconsin and was able to visit the Limburger place in the nation. And it was fantastic. I had a great time, and I have to say it's one of my favorite cheeses out there.
It's a wonderful cheese, and we have some really, really fine cheesemakers here in the state. Man, they're
you do, and it's funny coincidence, but yesterday and the day before, I've been at a Sonoma cheese conference, and I'm going to go back after today, and a lot of your cheesemakers are here with me. So I have Chris Raleigh of Dunbarton Blue is here,
yeah.
Sid Cook of Carr Valley, and then a lot of other people that are big in the cheese industry, like Jeannie Carpenter of Wisconsin Cheese Original. Mm-hmm. So I've been able to talk to them the past couple of days, and it's been great.
Perfect. Well, those folks that you mentioned, at least two of the three have been on this program. So,
nice.
Jean in Menominee has a question for you. Jean, hi. Thank you for calling.
Oh, hello. Well, you wanted us to tell about our favorite cheese.
Yeah.
It's Colby.
You love Colby.
And the fresher it is, the better it is, and especially the leftovers after they make it, the cheese curds.
The cheese curds, that's definitely
so they're still warm.
Yeah.
I grew up with it, exit 28, then you turn down to Spring Valley, and it's Katie Cheese. They make the best Colby.
Oh, Katie Cheese?
Yep. Every Friday they make Colby. But it's the cheese curds that are still warm that are so good.
Yeah. You know, in California, we don't really talk about cheese curds. You have some people who are making them more now, but I didn't know that cheese curds were supposed to be squeaky until I was informed in Wisconsin.
Well, it's
apparently
true.
This is the epitome of fresh. Yeah, I didn't know.
Yeah, if they don't squeak when you chew into them, they're according to anybody from Wisconsin, they're not fresh.
Right.
Well, you know, and speaking of, for you talk about fresh cheeses, and in your book, and there's at some point the fresh cheeses are. You know, they're meant to be eaten quickly. They're not meant to sit around, are they?
No, they're not. I mean, there are other cheeses that are traditionally, historically meant to age or to last families through winter, like the larger Alpine-style cheeses, that sort of thing. But the fresh cheeses, you know, they're meant to be eaten soon, especially when you get to the pasta filata style where they're stretch, like that really fresh mozzarella or burrata, those are meant to be consumed basically within a week or two, and they're delicious, you know, they're soft, and they are ready to go. They're just kind of the subtle, fresh flavor that you want with sandwiches or fresh mm-hmm. tomatoes during the summer.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I'm envisioning that right now, as a matter of fact. But as you point out in your book, they can go off pretty quickly.
They can go bad very quickly, and I think that sometimes that might influence people's perception about them, because if by the time it's delivered to you, you let it sit in your fridge for a week, this just really lovable kind of ice cream, happy-making style of cheese, it goes sour, and it's disappointing. And a lot of times if you get this cheese from Italy, per se, like burrata or the fresh mozzarella, it can be fantastic, but by the time it makes it all the way over here, especially in California, It's not optimum. Sometimes it's going to be good, but you never know how long it's been sitting on the shelf. So I like to get those style of cheeses from the United States, actually. I mean, not that it, you know, Italy yeah. knows what they're doing, but if you're going for those fresh cheeses, the closer you could get to home, the better.
Absolutely.
And the sweeter they're going to taste. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Dave in Cobb has a question. Hi, Dave.
Hello.
Yes. Good morning. I'm thinking about making my own cheese at home.
Mm-hmm.
Hello?
Yes, you're making your own at home?
I'm thinking about doing that, and I want to know which breed of cow would be the best. I'm thinking about a Jersey or a brown Swiss.
Oh, so you have a farm, and you're going to have a cow and make your own cheese. That's very in-depth.
Yeah, that is cool.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I think it just depends. Jersey cows they're so adorable. They have the biggest eyes. I love them for just the cow themselves. They're so sweet. But they also have really high butter fat, which is great when you're making cheese because it's a richer style cheese. They give a little less milk than a Holstein cow, but then you're going to have a higher butter fat, richer cheese. So it kind of depends on your preference with cow breeds and maybe even the cheese style you want to make.
Yeah.
Are you thinking of a fresh cheese or?
I was thinking more like something like a fresh cheese. And then I got a catalog from Grass Valley, California.
Yeah.
Pardon?
Yes, and?
And they got cheese-making kits, and I was thinking of trying the cheese-making kit.
Those are fun. I've definitely tried to make cheese at home, and I've had some successes and failures, and I'm very happy that there are cheesemakers out there who know exactly what they're doing. It's fun to play at home with this stuff. I mean, cheese-making used to be stuff that it was something that you did at home. It didn't become commercial until, you know, around the time of the Industrial Revolution. So it was something that people did at home. It was just like making bread.
Well, and yeah, and we had actually had someone on our show not long ago who's written a book about things you can do yourself, and she had made her own cheeses and had some recipes for cheeses in the book, which were pretty good, actually.
Did you make them?
Yeah, yeah.
Nice.
So it's possible to do it, that's for sure. Kirsten Jackson, our guest today, she has written the book, It's Not You, It's Brie, Unwrapping America's Unique Culture of Cheese. She'll be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network. Well, here in Wisconsin, we love our cheeses, and we are fortunate to have some great cheese producers and sellers in our state. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Lots of people think that if you want really good cheese, you need to get an import. But hey, fact is, U.S. cheesemakers are producing cheeses that rival the best that Europe has to offer. And whether you prefer a mild, soft goat cheese or a blue that will knock your socks off, probably a world-class option made right here in Wisconsin and certainly within the U.S., Kirsten Jackson is with us until 12:30 to talk about her book, It's Not You, It's Brie. I hope you'll join in with your questions and comments at 1-800-642-1234. And don't forget to check our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Like that page while you're there. We'll send you regular updates on upcoming show topics. And we'll be back right after the news. Cheese. There are few things that are such a pleasure to eat as it's cheese. And of course, here in Wisconsin, cheese is a big part of our culture. Probably as big as cheering for the Packers and toughing out those long, cold winters. Larry Mueller here with Kirsten Jackson, cheese and wine writer. She's a contributor to the Los Angeles Times, Kinfolk, Edible East Bay, and NPR's Kitchen Window. She's also the author of a great new book. It's called It's Not You, It's Brie, Unwrapping America's Unique Culture of Cheese. And she also blogs. She's got a great blog. It's Not You, It's Brie.com. Kirsten, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's so wonderful. I love to talk about cheese as you do and your book. You know, before we go any further, you've got such great stories in your book, and we really, I haven't asked you enough about it. So tell our listeners how you have your book organized. You've got some really wonderful stories that you tell and some really good-sounding recipes.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. So how I organize my book is into about 16 different categories. And it starts from the very freshest, which I call prepubescent cheese, the salad days. And it goes on into the crumbly mixed milk, aged sheep's milk, and then it finishes off with a bang for the sweeter style of cheeses, which tend to be Gouda style, and then, you know, blue cheese before that. And I organize the categories into these kind of genres, or, excuse me, I organize the cheeses into these sort of categories so that people can consider all the different styles that we have in American cheese and according of the most influential or the ones that are around the most. So I have these categories, and then within each category, I focus on three cheeses. So if you're looking at the Alpine style, for example, and you taste one that I think is a really good example of what some people are doing within that area, then maybe you could think, well, if I like this one, maybe I'll try the other two Alpine examples. And then I tell stories about if I was able to visit the farm. I visited about half the farms of the 48 farms. And I talk about what the cheesemakers shared with me. And at the end of each little section, I finish up with a recipe, and I organize the recipies in terms of, you know, I actually did it seasonally, kind of the way you would look at a menu, too, so starting from appetizers and finishing with desserts.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I want to try the Perlita meatballs.
I actually really love that one. I'm a big meatball fan in general. But
I am, too.
Yeah, they're fantastic, and I think that one is my lamb and pork recipe, and it's pretty good and savory. It's a nice way to mix another meat in there too, besides just doing pork or beef.
And Perlita itself, now that's kind of a, if that age is kind of an earthy kind of cheese, isn't it?
It is, and it's from New Jersey. You could order it online. It's one of the ones that isn't quite as available as others in the book. Towards the end of each little write-up of the cheeses, I give other recommendations, too, in case that one's not close to you. Maybe you could try another one of them. But the producer who made it actually started making a cheese because he wanted to make one that looked like Mimolette's. It's a very hard cheese that you find in France, and it has this very orange center, which is colored with annatto, which, you know, being from Wisconsin, you're probably pretty familiar with those darker oranger cheeses, which are often also colored and flavored with annatto. And this one is pretty orange, but it's also sheep smoke style, and Mimolette, the original, it's very old and firm and cow's milk style, so it's kind of a different take on that. And that's actually one of the great things about American cheese is that we can learn from these fantastic traditions that you have in Europe or Latin America, but we don't necessarily need to stick with them. We could experiment, and we could take some of our favorite things that we've learned from different traditions and then do what we want to do.
Judith's eyes lit up when you mentioned that French cheese, because she's married to a great guy from France, Jean-Marc.
Yes.
And it's his favorite, especially
it
aged.
Wow.
The extra aged is one that he loves the best.
Right. And have you ever
Mimoli.
Seen this?
I have not had it. I don't think.
Very fantastic. It gets the most beefy, caramely, but one of the unique things about it is the rinds. If you look at it, it looks like a cantaloupe on the outside, and one of the reasons for that is because the friendly little cheese mites actually kind of nibble away on the outside. I mean, we're not the only ones who like cheese. And by the time you get it, it's that rind is actually shaped by them them having a couple bites. The mites are gone when you get it, but it's kind of different.
Judith says, looks like a cantaloupe.
It looks exactly like a cantaloupe, like a little cantaloupe. Little yes. It's beautiful cheese. It's very, very fun.
Molly in Wauwatosa has been waiting a long time. Molly, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
You're welcome. And Kristen, I'm so glad you're here today. I am a new cheesemonger at Cermak Grocery Store. And I have a few questions for you, if you don't mind, too.
Okay.
I wanted to ask first about the brick cheeses, what kind of is included in there. I wasn't sure whether Limburger was considered that. I also have Widmer's. They're mild and aged out of Wisconsin. And I have the bulk white cheeses out of Wisconsin. And I'm wondering, some customers are saying, hey, that's not what I want. I want a different kind of brick cheese. And so I'm not sure what else might be out there. Can you fill me in on that?
Sure. So you have the Windmere's brick cheese, and you have the Limburger, and people are wanting a different style of brick cheese?
Yes, and then I also have the white, you know, just bulk 40-pound brick. But, yes, and there I'm going, well, what else is out there?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely tons of different artisan Wisconsin cheeses out there. But as far as brick cheese, you know, I have to say that I probably would have gone with the Windmere's, too. Beyond that, I mean, the tradition would be using bricks to weigh down the cheese. To my knowledge, that's what they're referring to. So,
yeah,
so I'm guessing that they just want to try other artisan cheesemakers or other cheesemakers in general, what they're doing with that. But as far as classic, I mean, I think you're right in that Windmere is one of the classic ones, and I actually really regret not making it out to that plant, the cheesemaking facility, when I was in Wisconsin.
Good reputation.
Yes.
My second question for you, Kristen, is about caring for cheese. And can you talk a little bit about parchment paper versus the other extreme of vacuum sealing and thick plastic?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I'm a big fan of using parchment paper or wax paper or even the cheese paper that you could get nowadays. Cheese papers would be a piece of paper on one side. It would be like a parchment or just a standard piece of paper. And on the inside, it has a very thin, I believe it's a little bit of a plastic covering, but it's breathable. And that's really what you want with cheese when you're taking care of it, because it's alive. It's a ever-changing entity, and it really needs to be able to breathe. If you wrap it tight in plastic or vacuum seal, at a certain point, you're suffocating the little guy. And it doesn't have time to change, and the flavors just kind of die a little bit. So essentially, you want to make it so that your cheese has room to change as it ages, in your fridge even. And a good way to do that, if you are a consumer bringing your cheese home, would be just to wrap it in the wax paper. And if it's a cheese that, you know, a lot of air would make it really dry, sometimes it's okay to wrap it very loosely in a plastic wrap just to get another layer in there. But you want to keep it kind of loose so it still has a little bit room to, you know, do its cheesy living thing.
Okay.
We're on the same track.
All right. Thanks, Molly.
Thanks for calling.
Nancy in Ridgeland, hi.
Hi, Larry. How are you today?
Great. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, great. Well, I'm a self-proclaimed cheeseaholic, so I look for cheeses all over the place. And, Larry, you started out your show by talking about both of the well-deserved reputations that Wisconsin has in both microbrews and the artisan cheeses. And I found a place, it reminded me of a place that I found up here in northwestern Wisconsin. It's called Foster Cheese House. And they honor both of those traditions very well. They have a big case full of wheels of artisan cheeses. They've got raclettes and gruyères and a bandaged cheddar and all sorts of really interesting kinds of cheeses. And the caller, I think it was Molly that was just before me, was looking for a brick. And I think a butter case is a brick. And I find that is just a stunning cheese. I just really, really like it. But the Foster Cheese House is right along the interstate, and it's one of the best-kept secrets around. People don't even know that it's there. There's a sign that sticks up in the air that says cheese, but it doesn't even start to describe what's there. Not only do they have all of, I think they said 50 or 60 different kinds of cheeses there, but they've got a big wine selection and a beer cave where you go in and choose the microbrew of your choice, And then they have a restaurant where they do wood-fired pizzas, and they're just amazing. They use all of these great cheeses on their pizzas.
Stop! You're making me hungry.
Oh, you have to stop there, Larry. It's right on I-94, and it's only one exit south of Eau Claire. It's like I said, I don't even think half of Eau Claire knows where this place is, but it's at Highway, I think it's at Exit 81 there. It's County Highway HH, but it's a Foster exit. And it's really, really a place to stop. It's a beautiful place. It's made of huge rocks. The whole place is made of rock stone walls. They have a fireplace in the dining room, and then you can watch the guys do the pizzas in the indoor pizza oven, and then there's one out on the porch for in the summer. You can have pizza out on the deck. It's really lovely. You've got to stop there.
Oh,
you know, I am all for people mixing cheese and beer and wine. I think it's a fantastic thing to do.
Oh,
yeah. Same place, and it's just, it's really merrymaking. All for it.
And I can't wait to get your book, Kirsten. I think it's going to be great to read about all the different kinds of
you.
Things.
Thank you
I
so
really
much.
I enjoyed visiting your state, too, so thank you.
So the Foster Cheese House, and I should mention that you were able to visit and have some, there are some favorites, cheese houses in Wisconsin that you point out in your book. I think we actually even put some of them up on our Facebook page.
Oh, thank you. Yes. I visited Shelley Cheese, which, as we were talking earlier, is the only remaining Limburger producer in the country, and I loved that. Myron Olson is the cheesemaker there. I believe he's also a master cheesemaker, which is unique to Wisconsin, and that was so fun visiting there. And I have family in Minnesota that I visited before I drove over to the Wisconsin cheese places, and so I kind of grew up with the Schloss and the Limburger and those kind of strong Washrhein cheeses, and it was pretty special to be able to visit a place since we don't really see much Limburger out in California. And then, you know, I got to visit some of the classic just places like Pleasant, to try the Uplands cheeses like Pleasant Ridge, and got to visit those. And then I believe you said you had Chris Raleigh on the radio too. Yeah. I got to visit his place and a couple more. I had a great time. I mean, Wisconsin is gorgeous too.
Oh, yeah.
And then to actually be able to eat the cheeses in such a beautiful environment, it was pretty special. Mm-hmm. And your cheesemakers are so welcoming.
Yeah, they're great, great people. And we have not only men. We have some women out there who are doing, I almost wish I hadn't started, because we have a woman here in the state who produces a goat cheese, and Judith is probably good. I'm sorry?
Is it LeClaire?
LeClaire, which was named the best?
Yes. Actually, I mentioned earlier that I was at the Sonoma Cheese Conference yesterday, and then today I'm going back to have the conversation, and she's actually there.
She talks
about what she's doing. It's really great with Wisconsin and California being able to, you know, share information to better the artisan cheese just in the country. And I talked with her yesterday, and she's amazing. She's also very young, and her family owns a goat dairy cooperative, and the cheese is fantastic, and it's pretty inspiring talking to people that are so passionate and knowledgeable about what they're doing, and she's definitely one of them.
Yeah, she is. I think she's working with her brother, too, on that. Austin in St. Paul, Minnesota, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hello. Yeah, I was a cheesemonger in St. Paul, Minnesota for about 5 years at a co-op, and I've been out of the job for about 3 years, so I may have fallen out of the loop and not heard a amendment in the laws, but the one thing that I really think is holding American cheese back from competing directly with European cheeses is the FDA's ban on raw milk cheese being sold younger than 60 days old. We actually have a producer in Minnesota who sells at a farmer's market, and they have a young raw milk cheese, but they actually have to sell it as fish food to be able to get it out on the market. I was just wondering what the author's thoughts on the raw milk cheese situation was.
All right, thanks for calling.
Wow, fish food, yes, because if they labeled it cheese, then they would definitely not be able to sell it. The FDA has a rule that we can't sell any cheese here that is made with raw or unpasteurized milk if it's aged under 60 days. We can't import any cheese either and sell it here if it's made under 60 days with raw milk. And I would love if we were able to sell raw milk cheese that's aged under 60 days here. You know, I think as adults and responsible consumers, we could say no if we don't feel comfortable with it. But I also understand the scare behind it. With raw milk cheeses, there's a higher likelihood of listeria contamination. Historically, that's what's been said. But I have to say, with some of the problems that have come up throughout the years, it's not very common. I mean, cheese is a food that is pretty staple when you think about it. I mean, more problems have come up with other things we don't need to necessarily go into right now, but cheese historically has not been the main problem with food contamination. But when it has been, to what I've heard as many problems with pasteurized cheese as unpasteurized cheese. What you need is someone who is experienced and makes their cheese in a safe way. And I think if you have cheesemakers that care about their craft and the tradition, and they're going to do that. Of course, every now and then there's going to be mistakes, but if you are careful about the milk you use, whether it's raw or pasteurized, I think that you are able to make a cheese that is healthy for people and that's safe, too. Yeah. I've had good unpasteurized and pasteurized cheeses, and I think the end thing is that it's the product that you start out with and the cheesemaker. So good cheesemakers are going to make a good cheese with no matter what they have, but would it be tastier if it was raw milk? You know, very, very often that's the case. It could be. Mm-hmm. It just depends on what they're doing.
Yeah. Greg, and thanks for calling us. And Greg and Glidden, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Kirsten.
Hello.
How are you folks today?
Great.
Good.
Yes. I do agree with your previous caller in Minnesota, Austin, about the cheese thing. And another cheese that I can't find locally in my neck of the woods is Manchego cheese. I've heard of it, and Bobby Flay uses it is it supposed to be like a Swiss cheese, a Spanish version of Swiss cheese, ma'am?
Yes, so Manchego is a sheep's milk cheese from Spain, and you're in St. Paul?
Nope, I'm in Glidden, Wisconsin.
In Wisconsin. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Well, I would check some of the stores in the book that I mentioned in Wisconsin to see if they have them there. You might be able to get it shipped to you, too, but essentially in the United States, we've been really influenced by Manchego cheese as far as sheep's milk, Pecorino cheese, and Pecorino just means sheep's milk cheese, and it's an Italian way of making sheep's milk cheese.
Yeah, and...
And then the Pyrenees, so the Spanish and French sides of sheep's milk cheese, and... because we've been so influenced by it, if you try a sheep's milk cheese by some of your local producers or go to your local cheese shop, I think they could lead you to either finding Manchego or they might be able to lead you to finding an American example of it, which would be pretty fantastic, too.
Yep, absolutely. Good luck, Greg. Thank you very much for calling. I want to give Alan Cocano a chance to join in. Al, hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What's on your mind?
You were talking about pairing cheeses with different foods and with beer and stuff. My grandmother, when we used to go out and visit her, and she would make apple pie, she would always put out a plate of cheese with it. And she would always say, apple pie without the cheese is like a kiss without a squeeze.
Apple pie without the cheese is like a kiss without the squeeze.
I like it. Yeah. I mean, there's that classic pairing of sweet and savory or sweet and salty, and I completely adore it, too. And you know, your grandmother makes that, and I've also had even pastry dough where people will make apple pie and then make the pie dough with cheddar cheese in it. It's delicious.
it absolutely is.
Yeah.
Well, My guest just ahead of you is Darren Bush from Rutabaga Canoes in Madison. And on the way out the door, he said, oh, you're talking about cheese. I'm in a cheese CSA.
Yes.
He gets three cheeses a month.
I think that's a smart man, yes. There are cheese CSAs, so community-supported agriculture boxes where you're essentially investing in the cheesemaker so they could have a steady source of income because, you know, dairying and cheesemaking is not the most profitable thing out there, and to be able to help them sustain what they're doing is something that makes it a little bit more probable so they could have a long-term career doing what they're doing. And there are even some really cool programs where you could, like, adopt a sheep. And you could, for $100, put in money and name the sheep, or you could invest a little bit more, and then throughout the year you'll get some of the sheep's product, like cheese or milk, and it's this fun way of having this farm involvement. And I have to say, I think in Wisconsin you guys are more surrounded around by it by some other areas of the country where, you know, sometimes out here people don't go to farms that often, and it's a way of having more of that.
And with that, we have to close. Kirsten, I hope you'll come back and be with us again. I really appreciate your time today.
Yes, thank you. And, you know, I think the first week of April, I'm going to be in Wisconsin, Chicago areas, and I'll post about it on my blog. It's Not You, It's Bree, if anyone would like to say hello.
And we'll maybe get you on the air then. Thank you for being with us. And thank you for listening. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.